Weird for June 1st, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
It's June 1st. I'm Chip Hessenflow.
I'm Pam Bedour.
Who are you on June 2nd, Chip?
It's a new month. A new coronavirus month, Steve.
Yes. As much as days matter, as much as months matter, it's, I forgot what day it was, about around last Blur's Day.
That's right. Start date, COVID-19.
This is chapter 11 of A Study in Scarlet. We are deep in the heart of Utah at this point and going through a whole series of events that is happening 40 years before a murder and learning all about the Mormon culture. 9 to 7?
Well, that's, we learned a little bit about code talking, Steve.
25 or 6 to 4?
Yes, that's the Chicago version.
And guys, we've been saying 40 years, but I think we do need to clarify that it's really about 30 years. Say Lucy's 15, right?
Okay.
Because when we met Lucy when she was 5, so now it's, say, 10 to 15 years later. And so we're 30 years before the London events.
Okay. I do forget about that time skip.
Me too. That's why I was like,
wait. The story began 10 years previous. So yes, right. You're right. We are looking at about 30 years before the murder.
And just quickly, I was kind of zooming around the Google this morning. I wanted to know if Doyle had ever visited Utah. And it looks like he did. According to this article from 2016, the Salt Lake Tribune, which is in Utah, he did visit. In 1923, he was doing a presentation on spiritualism, which is something that he believed in, and was able to tour on that. This chapter, along with these, all the chapters, don't necessarily paint the Church of Latter-day Saints in a positive light for this particular area. And he was asked a little bit about it, and he got to respond. He goes, all I can say of the Day-Night Band and their murders is historical, so I cannot withdraw that, though it is likely that in a work of fiction, it is stated more luridly than in a work of history. It is best to let the matter rest, I think, and draw the Mormons as they are now. So he certainly was trying to tiptoe around this, because just a few years ago, outside Washington, D.C., this book was banned as part of the reading for, it looks maybe a middle school. And it was banned in the sense that it was anti-Mormon. So as we're reading this, we can just recognize that it was a period of something of its state. And the Mormons certainly would not want to be portrayed that this is how they run their religion.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting because, as you know, Doyle wrote only 4 novels. And so this one portrays the Mormons, and his very last novel, The Valley of Fear, does a writing of the Molly Maguire story, which is another really complex American historical moment. And so I just want to note that in the 19th century, we have many detective writers who are engaging in complex sociocultural conflicts in a globalizing world. And so the one that comes to my mind, just because I've personally studied it a lot, is Alan Pinkerton's American detective memoir, where he wrote The Adventure of the Molly Maguires, and they were an underground secret society in Pennsylvania. So I think there is this real interest in detective fiction to think about, like, secret societies are obviously a really great topic, but if you're going to make them real ones, you have to think about who you're representing and how those readers might feel. And I imagine that because Doyle was in this very first novel thinking about his British audience, he probably wasn't super worried about how Americans might feel at that time.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But by the time he gets to Valley of Fear, he has to think about that. So to me, like, this part of A Study in Scarlet, and certainly the American portion of the Valley of Fear, it raises the question of what is the value, if any, of reading older novels that have biased or insensitive, racist, homophobic, or otherwise reprehensible representations of specific historical groups. I'd love to hear your perspectives on that.
And we've had a lot of conversation lately about all the Disney movies that have been put onto the Disney Plus service that have some historical roots, but not necessarily a actual history of a people other than the people who created those films? And are those perspectives, even though they don't mesh with our current beliefs, are they important to study? You know, Song of the South is not on the Disney Plus service because it is absolutely completely racist, and it is very problematic. Is it okay to eliminate those problematic things, to ignore those issues, or is it important to look at those for our perspective of today? That's a big question.
Well, in fact, some of the animated shorts out there have disclaimers that what was acceptable at a period of time is not acceptable now. Things were created. They were, especially something like a book like this, that was created for the mass market. Once again, what was acceptable at one time may not be acceptable now. The answer to Pam's question, if there's value in reading or experiencing something, there has to be. Because, you know, certainly once you have something revealed about yourself, use Mel Gibson as an example. Can you ever watch a Mel Gibson situation and not associate with the way he was portrayed and the way he acted during those moments?
And we've talked about this so many times, the separation between the art and the artist. You know, if a person...
It's very difficult.
If a person is a certain problematic person, can I still appreciate their creation? Can I still look at a piece of art? Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson problematic, but can I still love his music?
And that's very difficult. But when you were looking at writings are a way to kind of reach back into the past and maybe grab the zeitgeist of the time and get a feeling for how they were, you know, portraying people at a certain time. That doesn't mean it has to align with your life and how you value people. And obviously, there are situations where you're writing about something where groups, does Brigham Young, which interestingly enough, does represent the Mormons at that time, in this book represent the real Brigham Young? And if they are the same, you know, how has the Mormon religion grown from that period of time to now? And we've seen that the United States, if I would say that the history is a struggle in personal liberty for individuals, as the society has gotten wealthier, more educated in many ways, things that were acceptable 20 years ago or 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 200 years ago, certainly we've grown so much from that. And you know, as we're sitting around with people burning down and protesting because a certain part of our population was treated poorly, and it looks to be a symptom, it looks to be something that's happening more, that we're documenting more and more and more of that, you know, certainly society is going to push back when we do see injustice happening out there.
And I would just say, so at the college level where I teach, typically if I'm just going to teach one Sherlock Holmes text, I will teach The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, because you get such a nice variety of different kinds of stories that pull in all the tropes that students can then go off and explore. That's why I start there. I don't ever start with Study in Scarlet for reasons that are now becoming extremely clear to you guys.
Yes, and I appreciate that you started at the right place for us too, because you absolutely you've shown us what Sherlock Holmes is going to be. And now going back to this at the beginning, where Doyle is making a very strong statement. He's making a very cultural strong statement here. Whether or not it's true or fiction, the line is blurred here. But I think it's important to think about these issues at least.
Absolutely. And then if I teach a second Sherlock Holmes text, I always do The Valley of Fear, because that's one that gets into these really complicated questions about what is the relationship in popular fiction between reality and representation. And I just personally happen to have a really good background in the whole Molly Maguire situation. And so I would love the pandemic to end anytime, but if we get to that one, boy, I got some stuff for you guys. Valley of Fear is awesome, but it has these really problematic representations. And I actually know enough that I can talk the students through it, show them real documents, show them representations, and then think about, like, what are the rhetorical and cultural impacts of making the kinds of choices that Doyle made and that Alan Pinkerton made about the Molly Maguires. I'm not enough of an expert in Mormon history, and I have enough Mormon students in my class, and I just don't want to create an unnecessary awkwardness, because these, you know, when you're representing a labor union conflict, that's one thing. But when you're representing a religious conflict, I'm not trained for that as a professor of English. And frankly, you just don't want to put students in that position. But I think that as readers, it is really, really interesting to think about, like, what's at stake with this kind of representation? I think that in 1887, Doyle is trying to write something interesting. He's trying to look at this exotic American moment, but he's also playing with genre. Did you guys notice? He starts out, remember, as we've talked about, we've got the whole, he's working on the detective genre, still a new genre. He's got that chapter that's like total romance. And now we have moved into the Western genre, which is absolutely like the classic American genre in this time is the Western. Jefferson Hope is a Western hero. And so as we talk about him a little more, we can go deeper into that. But he's really trying, I feel like, is we got a 27-year-old writer who's trying to figure out who he wants to be.
He's Louis L'Amour before Louis L'Amour.
And you're right. He's playing with genre, which is pretty standard for a young writer. He's doing it really well. He's doing all of these genres really well. This is just not my genre. This is not what I signed up for when I started reading Sherlock Holmes. This is not Sherlock Holmes for me.
And let me throw this out there. If you're a young writer, you're also seeing what, or trying to attempt to see what the audience is looking for. And if you find that they're buying detective stories, then you're going to write detective stories. And if you find that they're buying Westerns, they're buying Westerns, or romances, they're buying romances. You may have a skill that the public is demanding, and it may pay for the passion that you eventually find. And spiritualism, it seems like the passion that eventually...
Especially if you have trained as a doctor, but you're not loving medicine and you're looking to make a career change. You got to figure out what, right?
Sure.
It's interesting. So getting into the details of this chapter, the Mormon leadership give Ferrier 30 days to decide which of the two men should be Lucy's husband. And as we noted last time, Lucy is not consulted in this. So Stangerson has four wives and Drebber has seven.
And it's so interesting to me that the leadership did say it is Lucy's choice. She is the one who is to choose, but there's no conversation with Lucy after that.
That's right. You can have behind, this is like, let's make a deal. You have between one and two. Which one would you like us to open? And you're like, well, what if I don't want to open either one?
When you're already engaged to someone else.
Right. And then we get this really disturbing countdown that is so malicious that Ferrier wakes up with a note by his bed with a number on it. And he keeps seeing these numbers appear in his home each day.
Well, they're not just numbers. They're countdowns. He was given 30 days to make this, make this happen. And every day the countdown happens. And, you know, it's like an Easter egg hunt. You can find out, where the number is going to be today.
The most malicious Easter egg hunt ever.
No kidding.
I was going to say, what kind of Easter egg hunt are you participating in? Good Lord.
I'm not going to your house
at Easter. Thanks for that.
It's like a little elf on the shelf countdown right there. You know, scaring the kids.
Elf on the shelf countdown. The ice cream bunny is coming.
And then we're almost at the last day when Jefferson Hope sneaks in. He crawls in. He knows that the house is being watched on all sides, and he gets himself in. So what do we learn about Jefferson Hope in this chapter, knowing that we're going to see him again in London 30 years from now with Sherlock Holmes putting handcuffs on him?
What he obviously understood what the message was that was sent to him. And he's a very resourceful person. He shows up, he crawls to the door. He knows what's going on. So there's a bunch of other stuff that we have listed here, right?
He's an excellent hunter.
Sure.
The ears of a lynx. This is zoomorphism that we hadn't seen before. I don't think we've had a lynx comparison yet.
Nope, that's a new one. We'll put it on the list.
Right out of a Western. Mm-hmm. Right. And when he makes a plan to get Farrier and Lucy out of Mormon country, I love, like, this sounds like dime novel Western. What if we are stopped? Asked Farrier. Hope slapped the revolver butt which protruded from the front of his tunic. If they are too many for us, we shall take two or three of them with us, he said with a sinister smile. So, he's not going to let this go.
He's that Western hero, for sure. He's that Clint Eastwood. I have a plan, and my plan is to shoot my way out of it. How American.
He will protect the girl. Mm-hmm. He's also at one with nature. So, with unerring instinct, Jefferson Hope picked his way among the great boulders and along the bed of a dried-up watercourse until he came to the retired corner screened with rocks, where the faithful animals had been picketed. The girl was placed upon the mule and old Farrier upon one of the horses with his money bags, while Jefferson Hope led the other along the precipitous and dangerous path. This is a very, very forbidding country, as we've seen earlier in the story. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who can take you through that. He can lead you through. He understands.
Well, in fact, early in this chapter, it's also mentioned, you know, why didn't Lucy and Farrier just pick up and leave? And they're being watched. They're being watched the entire time. And also, he says he doesn't really know the terrain that well, or doesn't know the land. He knows his immediate area, but not beyond that.
Yeah, exactly.
The Western genre. This is definitely the Western genre. We've got all the stereotypes. The old prospector type, the hero who's coming in to save the day, the villains who are out to get the girl and tie her up and put her on the railroad tracks. It's all there.
I bet Jefferson chews tobacco, too. I'm just throwing that out there. or smokes cigars. I'm just throwing that out.
He's not going to faint. We don't need brandy. Wrong genre.
You know, Steve, did you like the landscape descriptions? I know that you didn't love this genre, but there's some cool landscape, maybe?
Yes, there are some cool landscapes, but it is certainly not the cinematic sweeping description of the landscapes that we got in the first chapter of this part of the story.
Although I thought there was one quote that I want to read that I thought you might really like. It was a bewildering route for anyone who was not accustomed to face nature in her wildest moods. On the one side, a great crag towered up 1,000 feet or more, black, stern, and menacing, with long basaltic columns upon its rugged surface, like the ribs of some petrified monster. Come on, that's good.
That is good writing. That is a good description. That is certainly the exotic that we are seeing, something that London does not have.
Well, and it's also that idea of, like, this desert, this landscape. I love the image of the petrified monster, right? Mm-hmm. It's like it comes out of something monstrous, and there's just so little there to sustain you.
Isn't there somewhere in the writing that talks about water being far apart? That's really the challenge. They were found. They go to the Mormon community, and they're sort of creating the ideal life as a Mormon would. But yet they are also in prison in the sense that they can't leave because Jefferson Hope knows the way because he's off to go do whatever he's going to do. But they're trapped there because they can't just pick up and leave. When Hope arrives, I mean, that's the thrust of this chapter, is Jefferson Hope arrives and they're going to go on the run. They're going to escape and try to outrun the Mormons.
When Hope arrives, perfect. That's right.
Grab your gun, grab your money. We're off to try to escape this. All right, so I'm speaking strictly of how the Mormons are portrayed in this book. So this is not any particular group. And this could be any group that would try to set the situation up. But what I thought about was how amazing that a religion and people who demanded the liberty to run their community would subjugate a family who honored their traditions and to an outsider did nothing negative to impact the Mormon way of life. And only when the Mormon leaders demanded the surrendering of his daughter was external conflict provoked. So they provoked this response. And what an interesting presentation concerning power and a reminder that the individual can benefit or be destroyed by a society that does not honor the rights of the individual. And what makes this increasingly subversive is that the Mormon doctrine that God appointed their leader by direct command to coerce her citizens and force, if necessary, to the will of the Mormon leaders. And all I can say is when you give that type of power to a group, I mean, what can go wrong?
Yeah, again, Doyle is certainly presenting us with this moral dilemma. He is certainly laying this out for us on purpose to show us what power can do. And yes, the Mormons are, you're right, the Mormons are not necessarily the criminals in this murder mystery, but they are the ones who are held up as the example.
And as with all books, you're looking at maybe a specific situation or a specific group doing it. But it's talking about something far beyond. It could be any group that has this type of power.
Agreed.
Right. So guys, let's go to the ending of this short chapter where they end up at the very edge of Mormon country and Jefferson Hope knows the code to get out. And there's that from the one final sentry. So pass and the Lord go with you, said the voice from above. Beyond his post, the path broadened out, and the horses were able to break into a trot. Looking back, they could see the solitary watcher leaning upon his gun and knew that they had passed the outlying post of the chosen people and that freedom lay before them. The end. So, is everyone feeling really good? Do you think this is going to go okay?
No! This is terrible.
What's terrible about this? We know what's going to happen. We were at Sherlock Holmes time. But absolutely, if you were under that situation, you create this society where you're basically imprisoned. You have to conform to what the society asks you to. What do we learn from all situations like that? You want to escape it. You create the human trap. The human says, I'm not going to be trapped. I'm going to try to escape. And this is exactly what you would do.
Get your hands off of me, you dirty apes.
Exactly.
Sorry, you said human traps.
Well, I mean, it's the idea that humans want to be free to, or at least think that they control their destiny.
Right. Yes. I don't like this book. I like this writing. This is a great American classic from a British perspective. And let's get back to a mystery. Can we get back to the short story?
One more chapter, Steve. We've got this. Only one more chapter of the American part remains, and then we'll head right back to Watson.
The narration. Brandy again. And a sandwich at a regular hour. So what remains for us to find out? What do we need to... What did we find out anything in this chapter other than this deep, really moral tale?
Well, the one thing I thought back on is for the two murders that happened back in London, we had a word scrawled on the wall. It was Redrum, right?
And then Hornets after that. Hornets spelled backwards.
Something like that, right? Was it Raish? R-A-C-H-E.
Raish.
So Rachel, whoever that is, hasn't arrived yet. We know it's not Rachel, but what we do have is a clue that there is a group that is running around, certainly is able to enter places, leave clues, because they were leaving the countdown of how many days they had left to basically find the who was going to be the groom. We're getting a little bit, but hopefully we haven't really gotten that many clues, other than the names of some people that were related to that.
Well, we've met everyone, right? So we've met Stangerson. We've met Drebber, the first murder victim, the second murder victim, and we've met Jefferson Hope. So we got some stuff going on here. Ready. We're almost ready to solve this mystery.
Mm-hmm. We're on the run.
7-5.
All right. Avenging Angel. Next chapter. All tomorrow.
Right. All right. I hope everybody is getting all of this together and really understanding this and really appreciating this for its perspective, for its historical meaning, and hopefully enjoying the writing and the beautiful, sweeping, majestic descriptions of the land. That's good. Good. Good, Doyle. Good.
Eventually, we'll come to handsome nostrils shortly. You know, you never know.
Sensitive nostrils.
Sensitive nostrils.
Not central nostrils. That sensitive. Would be disturbing.
Hand-holding, you know, watching murders. You never know.
And Brandy. So what do you think? What, tell me, am I totally wrong? Are you enjoying this? Is this great writing? Give us an email. Give us a phone call. We'd love to hear your voice. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com. Get all of these conversations all in one place. We'll be back on Wednesday with Professor Bador to discuss Chapter 12 of A Study in Scarlet. We're almost through the American part and back to the mystery. So we'll hold on for one more day. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassan-Flood.
And I'm Pam Bador.
Where's my sandwich?